Hello, everybody.
Welcome to the PC Gamer Show. My name is James Davenport. I have some special guests with me today. Who's this here? Who's this back from vacation?
Hey there. Good to be back.
He has returned.
He has returned. This is Evan Lottie, Editor-in-Chief.
How's it going?
It's good. You're back. You're here to lead again.
I'm looking forward to hearing what game things occurred while I was out of town.
Oh, my God. It was just a mess.
Everything and nothing happened.
Yeah. And we're also here with Bo Moore.
That's me. Hello.
Technology editor. How are you doing, Bo?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. We got some good topics today.
Video games.
Yeah, yeah. Video games are still happening, even though...
computer games.
Whoa.
PC gotta draw a firm line. Games.
Yes, yes. Pretty cool computer games. So yeah, today we're going to talk about what we're playing. We're going to talk about sex games on Steam.
Whoa.
Sex games. We're going to talk about...
James, stop playing with your fidget spinner.
Sorry. Yeah, what the hell? There's the top of the tag pages for nudity, the nudity tag on Steam. One of the best sellers. Can you guys guess it?
Fidget spinner.
Fidget spinner simulator. I'm not going to play that game.
That's a good call.
We're going to talk about sort of the contentious events surrounding the PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds crate and key system. They had announced something over this new Gamescom tournament they're going to be holding. We'll get into that. And we'll end with Twitch chat Q&A, your questions. So let's get started. What have we been playing? Evan, did you get anything done over the break?
I was away from my gaming PC, of course.
Yeah.
But I just said we talked about computer games. It is a computer game. I was playing on a different platform. I continue to put time into Elder Scrolls Legends, which is, of course, Bethesda's, Elder Scrolls themed equivalent of Hearthstone, essentially. They had a new expansion recently. I'm really enjoying it. I'm an old school Magic the Gathering player, so it's kind of a way for me to get back into that scene. But since I got back, more with mouse and keyboard, thank God, I've been playing Day of Infamy.
Hmm.
So this is New World Interactive's Source Engine World War II FPS. It's multiplayer, it's cooperative and competitive.
Hmm.
I've been playing it exclusively cooperatively, and I think like 6 or 8 players can play. It's terrific. I would say it's essentially like, playing like a wave-based Day of Defeat or something.
Okay, I haven't heard that name in a while.
So. Yeah, yeah, no one really has. But It's exactly what I was looking for. I came back from vacation. I was like, oh, I really want to play just like a really straightforward kind of stripped down shooter. I don't want to get into like a Dishonored with lots of like story and dialogue and like upgrades. I just want straightforward, like shoot guys in a server, that kind of thing. And this is like exactly what I needed. I put like 10 or 12 hours into it over the weekend and, it's not the most polished experience in terms of like graphical fidelity, but there's like a really good selection of maps. And it's got that kind of like bottomlessness to it, I think, so a lot of the maps are like, well, they're either attack or defend.
Okay.
So, personally, I really love the setup of like defending objectives against AI. The AI aren't like especially intelligent, but they will gun you down. They will overwhelm you. So you have to like play intelligently. You have to think about what weapons you're bringing into battle and setting up and using your teammates and stuff like that. There aren't infinite respawns. A lot of the objectives play differently with how you respawn and stuff like that. But with like Dunkirk out recently, they actually released a Dunkirk themed map as well. Nice. Yeah. So, it's a terrific World War II game if you're kind of looking for that. If you miss old Day of Defeat, if you like really love Company of Heroes, that kind of thing, you can play as like British Commonwealth or allies, or there's even like Wehrmacht factions you'll play as. So like really good selection of authentic weapons. I would also compare it really, really closely to Rising Storm and Red Orchestra in terms of the weapon mechanics. Yeah. Like there's bipodding system, bolt action weapons, there's sort of a hold your breath system. It feels very similar to that, but comfortable. It's somewhere between simulation and arcade, which I really like.
Okay, and that's Day of Infamy?
Day of Infamy.
Is it still in early access or is that done now? It's out?
I think they're out of it. Gosh, I can't remember. Cool. They had a sale over the weekend. I can't remember what I saw on the Steam page. But yeah, definitely jump in there. Right. And I mean, there's a good amount of players. I had no problem getting into populated matches, and it's a fun challenge.
Nice. Good.
Very
good.
Cool.
How about you, Bo? You've been
I've been playing a handful of games. As per usual, the standard Overwatch, Hearthstone, Heroes of the Storm, you know, the little Blizzard trifecta there. But actually, I've been trying out a new game that I haven't mentioned before. Some of you may have heard the name, though. Yesterday, I installed Gigantic.
Gigantic?
Yes.
Okay, so this is, yeah, we have a great feature Steven Messner wrote. If you're unfamiliar with the game, you want to hear kind of the cool story, I'll link to it in chat. But, Bo, can you talk about your experience with it?
Yeah, so I haven't played very much at all yet. I've pretty much really just gone through, like, the tutorial and played a handful of Verse AI matches. I haven't done a full, you know, PvP match yet. But basically, the game, this, as you'll see in this feature that Steven wrote, it went through a very long story development. Was like the studio was on the brink of closing. Mm. It was originally an Xbox Microsoft exclusive. It was going to be on Xbox and Windows PC,
yeah.
Windows Store only, being published by Microsoft. But then at some point that deal, I guess, either fell through or something. It's all in the story. And the studio was like on the brink of closure. They couldn't pay their employees for several weeks, if not months, I think.
And they laid off a bunch of people.
They had to lay off a bunch of people. But the studio, the core people who stuck around, they were like, we've put in so much on this game. We want to see it through. And they kept working until the heads of the studio were able to secure a new publishing deal. So the story is very, very cool. In terms of the game itself, it kind of is like a cross. So the game was actually announced, I believe, before Overwatch.
Okay. This was a while back.
Oh, yeah.
it was a while ago. It was announced back when the, like, Overwatch likes were kind of all being announced around the same time. There was Gigantic, there was Overwatch, there was Battleborn, later on Paladins, like this genre that now has become very commonplace and kind of saturated. So if you kind of view it as it just coming out now, it feels like, oh, it's just another like hero shooter type thing. But it's been around for a while, and it really kind of marries the hero shooter aspects of Overwatch with more traditional MOBA elements. It's similar to Smite in that regard, but whereas Smite is like very, very MOBA-y, it's really just like a third person true MOBA with, you know,
yeah,
laning and creep spawns and, you know, your skill tree and last hitting enemies to get your gold and buying your items. This is a lot closer to Overwatch. It still plays pretty similar to Smite in terms of the mechanics of the heroes. It's third person. You have every hero has like a primary attack, a secondary attack. So basically your keys are your mouse one, mouse two, Q, E, and is there another one?
Tell me the button, Bo.
I don't even remember.
I mean, it's really like the map structure and the objectives that it differs the most on, including these gigantic enemies.
So the maps are, I've only played the one map, but it's much more of like a singular lane. There's a lot of verticality to the maps, actually, that I've noticed. There's a lot of high ground and going up and down under tunnels and over and stuff like that. But yeah, so the way it works is you, throughout the matches, you're generating energy through various things. You can build energy, or I forget what the resource is actually called. I think it's just power, actually. You build power by either going to certain spots on the map and like channeling it there for a second to draw some power. You obviously build some power by killing an enemy. And on these spots, you can both draw power and you can summon your own kind of minion to chill out there and defend that area. But you also have to defend that minion, because if the enemy kills that, then they're going to generate some power themselves. And once you as a team have generated enough power, your guardian can attack. And so each team has this big guard. I forget what they're actually called, but I'm going to call them guardians, which would be the equivalent, so to speak, of your MOBA base, I guess, your core or whatever. But once they've activated, they actually go and pin down the enemy guardian. And in that moment, like, the core is
exposed. And so you have a limited window in order to attack and hit and damage the core. And if you do enough damage within that window, then they take a wound, and three wounds kills the enemy. So it automatically does some damage just by your guardian attacking and pinning the other one. Whatever power is left over on the defending guardian is like translated into shield. So if they were really close to activating when you were, then they actually, you have a lot of shield to kind of get through before you can damage them. So it's sort of just a different kind of mechanic for the standard take on MOBA, like lane pushing and generating energy. It feels a bit like a specialized Heroes of the Storm type map, where you have these kind of specialized objectives that are different from your traditional just lane pushing, get to the core or whatever. But it's different in a way that's pretty cool. You know, it's got the third person. It's very fast paced, though. It's obviously, you know, you're moving with WASD, you're jumping around. It's got that quick movement of Overwatch or of these, you know, a third person type game. Obviously, you're not clicking around on the ground like a traditional MOBA.
Right. I mean, I've been curious about this game for a long time, as a lot of people have. But I'm curious if you think, I mean, it draws from MOBAs and it differentiates itself in big ways. But I'm wondering if you think it's distinct enough to, despite its, you know, long story development history, stand on its own. Or
it kind of is. I think it will carve a niche out. It's not going to take down Overwatch. Like, obviously, nothing is going to take down Overwatch. And nothing is going to take down League or Dota or Heroes. But it is kind of niche enough that I think it'll carve out a player base. It may be a small player base, but it will, I think, survive, at least for now. Everything that I've seen, reading through the comments on Steven's story, the Reddit comments from where that story was linked, a lot of people have basically just been giving it a shot and said, you know, I'm liking this a lot. Like, it's kind of different in an exciting way. So it's worth checking out.
For me, it's like, it's less of a question of how many games in the market are there that are aesthetically and mechanically similar to Gigantic, because, you know, you could say MOBAs are similar and Overwatch is similar, Battleborn, whatever. And it's more about how many games are there in which it's like roughly 5-on-5 competitive for like 30 to 60 minutes, you know, because I think there's a very specific type of gamer who's going to gravitate to that. And there's a finite number of those people in the world, right? And usually you want to play those games with your friends. I don't know about you guys. Like, I don't want to solo queue into any of those games if I have to. So I think that's the saturation that I'm worried about more than like how many games kind of look like this, right? Because you think about just the number of games. This is arguably like the best period we've had for competitive multiplayer games, you know, the sort of esports matchmaking, 5-on, skill-based matchmaking games. It's a real golden age for them, but there have to be winners and losers in that category. You know, I don't think it's winner take all. You know, obviously we've seen Dota and League have coexisted for years and thrived completely with a number of folks, you know, in that third, fourth position. But with Overwatch remaining seemingly very popular on PC, I guess we don't know like the concurrency numbers.
The millions and millions of copies, and Blizzard keeps every so often announcing like we've sold another, like reached another 5 million milestone. Yeah. They're at 25 or 30 or something million, you know, that's obviously like total sold. So the number will presumably keep going up, but and not all of those people are still concurrently playing, but the game is massively popular, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I'm more surprised we haven't seen fast Rocket League imitators yet, at least none that I've heard of.
You've seen developers.
It's been like 2 years or so, like maybe almost 2 years.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of competitive games that use orange and blue and sort of similar like aesthetics, but nothing straight up challenging Rocket League. I think that's a tall challenge.
But yeah, speaking of the, you know, the look of things, like the whether or not it plays similar gigantic, I mean, whether or not it plays similar to these other games, it does have a fairly distinctive art style. It's got this nice, cartoony, cel-shaded art style that looks really good. The animations are really fluid, and it's really pretty. Like, it actually, it's very nice looking. You feel like you're kind of playing through a comic book almost, kind of looks like.
Well, cool. I'm glad. I might check it out. I haven't installed, and I know.
Hop in.
Old.
We'll give it a shot.
Host Tom's been playing, and since Bo's on it, I might have to hop in too. Cool. Anything else, Bo? Anything else?
Those are the main things for me to hit on at this moment.
Can we talk about Doomfist at some point in this podcast?
We can. Yeah.
I am always going to
talk about Doomfist.
I don't know if now's the right
Invoke
time.
Invoke Doomfist.
All right. I mean, okay. I haven't played. I played, 10, 12 matches.
Yeah.
With, post Doomfist patch or whatever. He's crazy.
I think he's awesome.
I'm not someone who I really don't care about OP and all that kind of thing. I think it's sort of like not a useful tool in terms of describing characters, or at least it's like far often used when another word would be better. But the dude is insanely mobile, and he has a lot of escape, which I distinguish from being mobile. Mm-hmm. Right? His
Seismic slam
coming from the sky attack
can go surprisingly far when you're coming from the air. Yeah,
but the thing I was most surprised by, Bo, is that okay, I'm shooting him. He's got a lot of health. Is like
250 base.
Yeah, I'm slugging it out with him. I'm hitting him or whatever, and he does that escape up into the sky, and I know he's going to come down, and he comes down, but he has a shield.
Yeah,
when he comes down.
Yeah.
He goes so I'm like, okay, I've got him. I'm waiting for him to drop down. I hit him, and he's he goes up in the sky with one sliver of health. I'm like, all right, comes down. I didn't kill him. I hit him right as he hits the ground. I'm like,
yeah, it's because also all of his abilities, if they do any damage, they generate a flat 30 shields. Those shields do deteriorate over time, but it's a pretty slow deterioration. Huh. And the biggest reason why he has those is because a lot of people have actually been saying Doomfist, people are bad with him, because in the same vein of Zarya, he has a very big hitbox. He has an almost tank size hitbox, and he is very when his abilities are off cooldown, he is very mobile. So he has escape abilities, but other than that, he's pretty slow. He kind of walks at normal speed. He doesn't have the quick zipping of Genji, the double jump or the wall run. And so in that regard, if he misses his hits, he is so easy to just crush. Mm-hmm. His hitbox is huge for a DPS character. Compare his size to someone like Tracer or Genji. They're much, much smaller than him, and just frankly much harder to hit. This kind of depends a lot on what skill bracket you're playing in, whether or not people are able to hit their shots. The thing is, because his playstyle is so aggressive, and in order to do any damage, he has to be up there in the front lines, which means he's very, very vulnerable. So those shields are without them, he would just get deleted so easily.
I guess so. I guess my main objection there is it was in no way evident to me that doing an attack would cause him to get a defensive buff, essentially.
I mean,
I actually had no idea. And I should have read up or whatever, but it's not evident to me through fighting against him that he earned shields, which is essentially a drain attack.
It sort of is.
By hitting me.
Yeah, so
doesn't feel visually represented to me.
I can understand that. Yeah. And that's something that's just in the patch notes.
Take responsibility for his design.
I mean, but if you compare him though to Reaper, Reaper also has 250 health instead of the 200, which is standard for other DPS heroes.
He's got a big escape ability.
He has a big escape ability because he is to do damage, you've got to be up there in the front line, point blank range. And he's very vulnerable if you catch him without his escape or anything. And to that end, I don't know if you saw, they recently changed Reaper's passive. So instead of generating health by collecting the soul orb things, which was basically only useful after you had killed somebody, it was kind of a win more type ability. They change it so his guns have a passive lifesteal, and that kind of plays similarly. Like, again, it's something that's not visually represented. You just kind of have to know, like, while he's shooting you, he's going to be getting some health back. And so I feel like Doomfist's passive shields are very similar in that regard. If he's hitting you, if he's doing his job well, he's going to be tougher to take down than you expect.
Yeah. Okay, one other thing on Doomfist. So I've noticed a lot of other discussion around Roadhog. Mm-hmm. I've watched some touching tribute videos about, you know,
are they angry and ranting?
there was one that was like, you know, set to piano music in black and white, where it showed, like, I think if you look up Save Hog on YouTube, you'll find this.
Oh my god.
So it showed, like, it was like really, the composition was really clever. So it was like him pulling like 10 characters toward him. So you see him pull and pull and pull, like, mm-hmm. these, you know, with his hooks, these like really good grabs. If you don't play Overwatch, it's like Pudge in Dota or something, right? So he pulls all these characters toward him. And then it shows the successive, like, follow-up shot where he hits them all point blank and none of them die. None of them
die, yeah.
None of them die. And then all of them kill him. So it's the point it's making is, old Roadhog could one-shot, like, almost everybody in the mm-hmm. game. You know, not Reinhardt or something. But, you know, could put up all these, you know, the reward for grabbing somebody was essentially like a guaranteed kill or something close to it. And I guess my understanding is, like, Blizzard doesn't like the idea of these one hit kills. Yeah. Like, that was their rationale specifically around Roadhog. But my understanding is that Doomfist can one hit kill 18 different characters on the roster. So
how
does that line up, Bo?
Yeah, I totally
what's
understand.
Going on there? OTK.
Yeah. It's hard to reconcile. And I think the main differences are, one, Roadhog is technically a tank as opposed to a DPS hero.
Okay.
Like, DPS heroes are meant to be able to quickly kill people. Like, a Tracer who catches you unaware, like, should be able to. It's not technically a one-hit kill, but, like, a single clip of Tracer should be able to kill mm-hmm. most heroes. So, like, DPS heroes are meant to do a ton of damage in a short period of time. I understand the one-hit kill. He kind of comes out of nowhere. He's meant to punish people who are out of position, though. Because, like, people, if he charges in unaware, like I was saying earlier, like, he should immediately get overwhelmed and taken out. I do agree that the one-hit kill is on Roadhog versus his. I guess also the difference is, with Roadhog, if you miss the hook, there's no punish for him. Mm-hmm. He's still in his back line.
Right.
He's still with his tanks.
He's not made vulnerable.
Right. Yeah. Whereas if Doomfist misses his punch,
he's out of position.
Dead, basically.
Yeah.
And it is a one-hit kill, but it is a high-risk, high-reward one-hit kill.
Because mm-hmm. You have to judge that distance really well. And obviously, like, line it up so if somebody's moving.
Yeah. Because it's not, you don't just have to land it for it to be a one-hit kill. You have to land it and for them to hit a wall with the knockback.
That's right.
Because the punch itself only does 100 damage. It's the knockback that actually, if they hit a wall, that'll do up to an additional 150 or more, I believe. So yeah, it is a one-hit kill, but it's not guaranteed. And also, you know, if they receive some healing in between the punch and the wall, like, it might not kill them. Yeah. I think the biggest difference, though, is in the risk-reward factor. Like, it is risky, but it's a one-hit kill. Whereas for Roadhog, if you miss the hook, like, it's no big deal.
Okay. All right. I think you persuaded me to delete my angry forum rants against Jeff on the Blizzard forums.
Just because we're on the subject of Roadhog, though, and because I'm a little proud of this moment, James, I'm going to send you a gift that I took of a Doomfist moment that I thought was really cool. And it was using, I was really happy to use
hashtag Doomfist the new,
the new highlight system that Blizzard recently implemented. Made it really easy for me to export this highlight and
I'll see if
turn
I get
it into a video.
I'll get it on screen. Did you send it in Slack?
I Slacked it over to you.
I will quit slacking and get in there. And all right, let's see if I can get this going.
I mean, it's a fun character design overall. I mean, I really enjoyed that aspect of it. And, you know, it's sort of like a brawling melee fighter. I mean, that's something unique.
It'd be a bit choppy on stream, but here we go.
You might have to wait to loop around and see the full thing.
Okay.
For the full effect. I was pretty proud of this one. This was like my third game
with
Doomfist.
Walk us through it, Bo.
So it was just a highlight. It was no play of the game, but we're here on Dorado. So I use his verticality to get up there, take out the soldier 99. On the high ground.
Yep.
And then jump down and just delete the Anna.
Oh man.
She had no idea what was coming. I was pretty proud of that.
So the cooldown on that looks pretty short. That's nice.
The punch itself is only a 4 second cooldown because that's his primary attack basically. His shooter, his gun does next to no damage. Mm-hmm. It actually kind of does a surprising amount, but it only has 4 shots and it recharges pretty slowly. Like that is his way to do damage. So it has to be on a short cooldown. They couldn't make that like a no cooldown type thing. It's meant to feel powerful when you hit somebody with it, but you have to be able to do it a lot because that's like his only attack. So, you know, if you just tap it, it does much less damage. I mean, it's still like it hits for 50 and then maybe another 50 or 75, which is, you know, nothing to balk at, but like it is to do the full 250, like you got to charge up for a couple seconds. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, thanks for that. Those words that I didn't really understand at all. But
Doomfist.
Doomfist. He looks cool.
Doomfist. Not totally OP. There you go. That's kind of how we'd summarize it. Yeah.
I'll move quickly through what I've been playing. Well, not too quickly. But really, I want to give a shout out to DJ Bruce, one of our club members, known as Butts in the club. Head to club.pcgamer.com if you're curious what you can get out of that, but you can join our really fun Discord and meet people like DJ Bruce. He's been in the hospital.
Oh, man.
And he's still tuning in. Something to do with his
appendix.
So maybe if it's too hard, don't do that. Just like chill and, I don't know, get better. But thanks for your dedication.
Thanks for sticking with us. Hope you get better soon.
get that appendix upgraded.
Get it out of there.
Get more appendix in your VRAM or
appendix gigahertz.
I don't know. Bodies.
I want to talk about a game that came out yesterday and that I finished it last night called Tacoma.
Yes. Tacoma. I'm so excited to play this game.
Nothing to say about the meta. No new characters coming to Tacoma as far as I can tell. But this is a new story-driven game from the creators of Gone Home. And if you don't know Gone Home, sort of kicked off along with Dear Esther, the walking simulator genre, as it's commonly referred to today. Last show, we actually decided to rename the genre.
I missed this.
What is the name?
Do you remember, Bo?
I don't.
What?
I don't, actually.
You made it up!
Did I? What did I name
it? In these games, you explore spaces.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So they are now called Space Explorers, which is super appropriate for Tacoma, which takes place in a space station called Tacoma.
How did I forget that? That was genius.
It was genius. Come on, Bo. He's got to save that ego space in his brain for play of the games. Tacoma, it's very different compared to Gone Home, which took place in a big house in Portland, or on the fringes of Portland. In a space station, there's different... let me set up the narrative first of all. You're doing contract work for a company, I think, called Venturis Corps. And this space station is basically think of it as like a truck stop way station for looking at cargo, looking at shipments that are being pushed to these developments orbiting Earth, basically big space condos. And it's where materials and so on and so forth get checked before being shipped and used to build. In Tacoma, in Tacoma's future, AI is a thing and completely capable of automating these space stations themselves and these processes themselves. But because capitalism, yada, yada, people still need jobs. And there's sort of some background material you get exploring the space station that details what's been going on and sort of the you know, what will probably be a problem in the future for us. Where are the jobs going to go if computers and robots and everything can automate them, right? So there's legislation that exists in this fiction that mandates, people still need to work because they need money. And so on this giant space station, there's something like six people. And you are going there after an event occurs in which these people disappear. Now, it's not like Gone Home in that you're just exploring a space and rifling through their underwear drawer and like finding notes that they conveniently explain everything about them. There's some of that. There's still a lot of that. But you're exploring a space station and witnessing these futuristic holographic recordings of events that transpired over the course of a year. Some of those are from like an hour before you got there, and some are from, you know, when they first moved in. And it changes the game from, or at least the feel of like the typical walking sim where you, you know, piece
space
together,
explorer,
space explorer, shit, damn it, Bo. Where you piece together the story through epistolary notes and just like, oh, there's a broken lamp and a skeleton, you know, what could have happened here? And it changes it into more of like a performance. And there's something called, a show in New York, is it? What's
worth? Yeah, yeah. There's a play type thing in New York called Space, not Space,
Space Explorers.
Sleep No More. that's like a, it's an interactive, semi-interactive type play where it's set in like this old hotel, and over the course of I guess like 2 or 3 hours, instead of sitting in a seat and watching a play in front of you, you and the other guests for the night walk around this hotel and go from room to room. And there are people playing out a narrative in different rooms. So they all have a script. The players have a script that they're following for the night, so to speak. I'm sure they ad lib a little bit here and there. But as far as I know, they have a script that will then play out over, you know, the course of the entire night. So some things will happen in this room, some things will happen in this room. And it's the kind of thing that you can't actually see everything happening at once. Like I've heard of, so I haven't actually seen the show myself, but I've several friends who have gone and said it's a really, really cool experience because you're getting to experience this, like, you know, period of time, this story play out, but you can kind of view it from different angles and different things, and you can follow, you can see like, oh, this is what's going on here, and I really want to see where this goes, so I'm, if this person goes to the other room, I'm going to follow them and like see what happens. Or maybe you're like, this is, I'm not really interested, like let's go see what's going on in that other room. So you get this sort of like, it's like being an, they don't interact with you though, so it's like being this omniscient observer, like at a party, more or less. You're seeing what's happening, and you get to peer into these people's lives through these moments in time.
That's exactly what Tacoma is like. And except you can, like a VCR, and there's even a cool like VCR style effect added onto it. You can see these silhouettes of people, and you can rewind these sequences, pause them.
Very cool.
And at certain points, like they'll whip out their AR interface, and you can't see what they're looking at directly, but you can pause and click on their interface and try to like recover their corrupted files and sort of sort through. They're texting other people at that time on the ship or back home, or they have email correspondence with somebody, you know, off station, or, and there's some cool stories and relationships you can put together that way, or at least strengthen that way. And it's integrated super nicely. Like I don't feel like it cuts the flow down of the, you know, of the action too much. And in the end comes together, informs a story that I don't think is, it's not space opera sci-fi. This is speculative fiction and fairly optimistic, which is
nice.
In my opinion, pretty refreshing, to have a sci-fi story that's not doom and gloom and technology ruins everything. And if anything, it turns the mirror back on, you know, people and says, you know, does the evil in technology start with us or, you know, somewhere else? So very, very cool game. It's short. So if it's not your thing, you know, it's probably not going to change your opinion of space explorers, walking sims. But I think along with Edith Finch, I'm forgetting the full name of the game.
What
Remains of Edith Finch. It's showing that kind of game, a narrative focused game that wants to tell you a story in first person or not, like, can change and work and grow and surprise us today. So very pleased with it.
Yeah.
Very pleased with it.
Got it. So it's Prey without the scary aliens.
Oh, I should say you're going to be entering 4-digit codes to unlock stuff.
Heck yeah.
So
nice.
If you love that, doing that in space, this game has got you covered.
Is one of them 0451?
I'm not going to say, okay. But...
spoilers.
All I really want to say on this, though, is like it's really nice to see that as I said, I loved Gone Home. I thought it was a great game, but we touched on this a bit on the show last week. Like the just listen to audio logs mechanic of the walking simulator genre has kind of been played out at this point. And so it's just really nice to see that this genre of game has evolved into a new mechanic, a new way to experience these stories and tell these stories in an interesting way that doesn't, you know, feel played out. And for all we know, there may now be a handful of games that copy this mechanic and we'll get tired of it and they'll have to do something entirely else. Yeah. But for now, it's really nice to see that it's come to this.
Yeah. Every few years I like having one or two of these a year, just roll through in 2 hours and be done with, as opposed to Dark Souls, which I can't quit playing. That's the other thing I'm playing is more Dark Souls 2.
Yeah, of course you are.
DLC, which is excellent, excellent, excellent stuff. Beyond that, more Fortnite. I'm playing a lot of Fortnite, like 15 hours into Fortnite, and just feeling very fatigued by all of the loot and pinatas I've smashed, and how very little challenge I've felt still.
Speaking of loot.
Oh.
Segue.
Where are we going with this? Oh, you're segueing for me.
Yeah.
I like this. wait, I got to type it in the thing. But maybe you can talk about this in depth or explain what's been going on, Evan. PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds has had this crate system in the game for a bit. But with this Gamescom tournament, they're introducing sort of a lock and key payment system before the game is out.
Yeah, so since launch, I guess, early access launch, you know, if you play Battlegrounds, you get this currency by winning and scoring hits and kills and stuff like that. You can spend that currency on these free item crates, which include, like, there's actually like a very limited selection of items since launch, like, you know, t-shirts and different types of jeans and boots and stuff like that, like really kind of simple looking cosmetic stuff.
It's all cosmetic stuff. There's nothing gameplay related.
It's all cosmetic stuff.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
So that system is essentially continuing. There's still going to be some free crates. There are going to actually be two free crates in the game. And they have like some of them have like rare or uncommon or common items, right? But in addition to that, they're introducing separate paid item crates that are include like an entirely different set of items. And if you've seen any of the recent screenshots that they've been sharing, like from the movie Battle Royale, for example, like all of these, like basically the coolest looking cosmetics are going to be behind these paid item crate systems. So if you play Team Fortress 2, if you play Dota, if you play Counter-Strike, you're familiar with the system. It's priced basically exactly the same. You're going to get these crates by playing. You pay $2.50 to get a key to unlock them, and they will contain. Okay, so yeah, if you've seen these screenshots, like they've actually designed some outfits that look really cool. They're based on the movie Battle Royale, like little nods or homages to the costumes that the characters wear in that movie. But you won't get the whole costume. That's the other thing. You'll get a piece of it. So depending on how many pieces it contains, like a tracksuit, you know, to get the jacket and the pants, and if there are also shoes, that might be $750 minimum, right? Because they're going to be random.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very familiar system. It has been, I think, you could say it wasn't met with a positive reaction by all players for sure. And I think one of the reasons there was in interviews as recently as like early May, Brendan Green, AKA PlayerUnknown, leading development of the game, of course, he said that, and he told Kotaku that We're not doing monetization during early access. It'll be afterwards, so we have so we'll have keys to open crates to make it simple. So they've talked about this in the past, but it's a bit of a surprise that it's going to be coming during early access. Mm-hmm. I think that's the main thing that's getting under people's skin, almost along the lines of the outcry we saw around Ark Survival Evolved, where they added a whole paid expansion while the game is still in early access. So, you know, a little bit of friction there for sure. But yeah, I guess what's our take on this?
That's what I want to know is, like, should we be surprised if early access games that eventually need to make money, should we be surprised if they are testing payment models while in early access? Should that be a commonly accepted thing? Sure, he said, I think maybe a bit too early into the development process that they wouldn't be doing that. And I don't recall Ark ever saying they wouldn't. But I think there's this understanding, or at least impression, that early access means what we're paying for is an in-development build of the game. Any updates to that should be included in what we paid for. And beyond that, you know, if you need to generate further, you know, revenue, that should come after a 1.0 release. I don't know. It's very, like, consumer-minded way of thinking about it. But I'm wondering if you guys think we need to be angry or surprised when early access games test out these, you know, payment models.
I guess I'm a bit unhappy that the precedent continues to erode, you know, and I don't know, like, who do we blame here? I think I wrote about this, I don't know when, a year or two ago, you know, Valve needs to take sort of responsibility, I think, for what early access is. I think Valve, you know, any person who's spent a reasonable amount of time on Steam and kind of following what they do, they really prefer a laissez-faire kind of hands-off approach to things. They intervene when necessary, when there are, like, major issues, like there were around paid mods, for example, and huge outcries. But the issue here is that developers who publish early access games control, through their actions, what early access is and the perception of it, right? Valve is not an enforcement group, unless there's, right, like, major issues, like censorship issues or content issues, which we'll be talking about later in the show. But essentially, you know, when developers, you know, whether or not you think Battlegrounds made an error here or sort of went against trust, I think they certainly contradicted their earlier comments about their intention to do this, and they did apologize for that in the patch notes. You know, PlayerUnknown himself was talking about how this was poorly communicated, and they apologized for that. But I think that the bigger worry here, it's not just about, oh, we're gonna have to pay to get cool items. Oh no, like, that's frustrating, and they're really popular, and they're just kind of, they want more of our money. I think the bigger issue is early access's reputation. You know, Think about the positive reputation, the almost exclusively positive reputation Battlegrounds had up until this was talked about, right?
Hard corner.
I think almost everybody held it up as, and I would see these comments all over the place on our site and on Reddit and elsewhere, this is early access done right. This is how you do it, guys, because they were constantly talking about the next thing around the corner. They addressed optimization stuff. They addressed their net code. You know, they continue to have server issues here and there, like, intermittently, but, you know, they're a big popular game. We'll give them some slack for that. And they were really focused. It seemed like they were updating the game constantly and talking about new maps that are coming. You know, that was all really encouraging. And now there's sort of this, like, oh, shoot. Like, you know, of course they're going to use what is, like, the most popular or slash successful, however you think about it, monetization scheme that Dota and Team Fortress and a lot of other games have used. So that's a bit of what I'm worried about. You know, I feel like we should be concerned about how early access is perceived, because a lot of good developers are doing a lot of great stuff there, and I don't want them to sort of be hurt by the questionable actions of others. You know, that's a shame if so, because it is a useful program when it works.
It is. And it is a bit out of the blue, I think, to just, you know, start charging, even when they said they weren't going to. But, Bo, do you have any thoughts on keys and crates and money?
I mean, so I haven't played too many early access games. I haven't played, like, any Battlegrounds, so it's a little bit out of my depth. But a little bit of the comparison I can make is to Blizzard games and the cosmetics there mm-hmm. is, you know, there are crates that can be purchased for money, but you also earn them by playing. And right. I feel like, at least for me, that's a big distinction and a big difference, is that if I want to pay money to get more of these, it's fine, but like I don't have to. And I can still maybe not have a super fair shot at getting everything, but like if I play enough, I'll get the things. And that basically assuages all worry that I have about there being microtransactions in this game. And to that end, actually, there was, with the big 2.0 update to Heroes of the Storm, they switched from most of the cool cosmetics being tied behind paid money, the gem system right. that you had to pay for,
right.
or that you did earn a few of, but like very, very few. Whereas all you could like unlock heroes with gold, and which was the part that, mm-hmm. you know, matters for gameplay, but all of the cosmetics were basically monetary. With the 2.0 update, they added this shard system, which is similar to gold or whatever in other games, which is, you know, you can unlock cosmetics with, if you play enough, you can unlock whatever you want. Some of them may take a very long time, but you do not have to spend any money.
Very similar to Overwatch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you're getting drops incrementally. You're getting this currency.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that made a big difference for me in playing the game. Like, you can say cosmetics mean nothing, but they obviously mean a great deal to a great deal of people. Like, people care about what their characters look like in games. It's the reason why skins are such a big deal in Overwatch and in all of these games. It's why this is even a topic of conversation. And so, yeah, like, I feel like, I mean, I'm of the opinion that all games should be this way, whether they're, you know, out or in early access or whatnot. The fact that the game is in early access muddies the waters a whole nother step that I don't even know how to take, how to address. So, yeah, I mean, that's just where I stand on the microtransactions deal.
Sorry, Evan, were you going to say
that? Oh, it's fine. I just think as a player, the biggest mistake that they're making is that they're creating like this hard wall between the free cosmetics, which I think look really, really basic and dumb, like plaid shirts and striped shirts and like jeans.
It's like
you know,
Target clothing section.
The rare ones, I believe, are like a skirt and like the leather jackets that have already been in the game. You know, right, I don't know. There's nothing remarkable. Like, if there was a chance, like just a 0.1% chance, 1% chance, whatever, like of me getting effectively a legendary item in those crates, that completely changes this for me. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm gonna keep playing on the hope that maybe one, you know, in 6 months, I'll have a couple of these or something, you know. Cool. But the fact that they're creating this clear barrier between these are monetized items that you can only get by buying keys, and here are the free items that you'll only get by just playing and accumulating currency. I don't know. That's not cool to me. But
it's not cool to me either. It's early access continues to be a strange thing.
Yeah.
They do say that the funds are going directly towards funding this Invitational, the Gamescom Invitational, and supports a selection of charities. So that's nice, but, you know, because they're very much the top-selling game on Steam.
Wait, they've said they support charities? The keys support charities?
The
tournament.
Yes, to support a selection of charities as well, and the prize pool and, you know, funding. So that's nice, but I think it could have been done better.
Sure.
There's test this out on the PTS and refund, you know, in some type of in-game currency, the money spent to test it to the players when it becomes implemented later on. And messaging was unclear, as they said, but
yeah. Okay. I mean, the alternative though, let's be devil's advocate for a second. It's a $30 game, right? I believe it's $30 right now.
Yes.
The alternative is, well, okay, every time we release a new map, it's $10. Do we want to live in that world, or do we want to live in the world where a jacket, the possibility of a cool jacket, is $250? You know, you have to pay to roll those dice, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because at the end of the day, they are just cosmetics. Like, you can play this game, assuming you've bought the game, you can play it for the entire game. You can play it. Like, you're not limited. It's not pay to win.
Yeah, you know. There's maybe a remote possibility that in the future they introduce something that has like some optical advantage.
Yeah, like, maybe there's like camo or something.
There's a possibility of that, but I don't know.
But there's not like your gun shoots better anything of that regard. Yeah. So because that obviously is what we definitely decry as, you know, do not do.
And I don't want the player base to be fragmented in a game where the server is 100 players.
No,
not at all.
Right. And as they introduce these maps, as they introduce first person only servers, which they're going to do in this upcoming patch, the game's going to get more fragmented. Right. As much as it's well populated now, one of the joys of playing that game is I know I'm going to instantly get in a server with 100 people. It's going to take 30 seconds at the most. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
it's going to be an interesting challenge for them just to grow that game and, you know, maintain the momentum they have and, you know, player base they have. But I'm excited at least to follow it and see where, you know, where it goes from here. I did see, I don't know when they're implementing these, but Ollie Moss was making a custom player, a Battlegrounds item, and it's a fucking Garfield helmet.
Yeah, I saw that too.
You saw that too?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
It's a helmet with like Garfield ears and eyebrows or whatever. Yes, yeah.
So
it's
pretty amazing. Might be bright orange, but it'll be worth it.
Promising.
It's the old Tyler Wilde special.
The Tyler Wilde
special. I mean, okay, the other thing we should just touch on briefly, sure, just hint at is, okay, like, there's going to be an item economy. Like that's what this is going to, there's already Steam Market support for the game. People are already trading items. We wrote about the fact that, if you didn't open the Twitch Prime crate, that you got by connecting your Twitch account with Battlegrounds, it was worth like $25 or even $30, I think, if you didn't open it. It's really like it's stupid. It's like a ski mask anyway.
It's awful stuff.
So, you know, Counter-Strike has gone through a lot of tough moments over the past couple of years with skin gambling and these other like third-party services springing out. So what is Battlegrounds going to do to combat that stuff, control that stuff? Can we expect something similar, like all these kind of like third-party websites based in Russia to spring out of the ground? Mm-hmm. Are people going to start betting on tournaments? That's going to be interesting to follow for sure. But yeah, maybe anticipate that a little bit.
Definitely. Let's move on to the next topic. Which also involves Steam and sort of their muddy take on how they define or enforce some things.
This is a steamy topic, James.
Oh my God, damn it. I don't know. I didn't use that in any of the articles I wrote about this. But if you're unfamiliar, a game called House Party released on Early Access, I think about a month ago. And in this game, it's a first-person adventure game. Adventure game, I use loosely. But where you're at a house party and there are, I don't know how else to describe them, but physics boobed women there and they are doing things that make them use physics and, quite a bit. They have tasks for you. You run around the house and like pick up their phone. Yada, yada. End point is there are sequences in the game where you in first person whip out your dick and can have fully simulated sex with these women.
Nice. All right.
And this has been on Steam for a month. There was an option in the options to censor it with black bars, which was kind of hilarious, like seeing in 3D space these black bars like try to cover
floating around.
It's ridiculous looking. Recently it was removed from sale, sort of out of nowhere, at least for the developer on Steam, citing complaints about pornographic content. There is pornographic content in there, right?
For sure.
And the developer put up this big blog post kind of explaining, you know, their situation and that they understand why Steam did this, but also kind of bringing up the point that why the guidelines aren't clear to begin with. Steam Direct's guidelines only state under things that you should not publish on Steam as directly related to sex as pornography, which is pretty clear to me, right? But how did this guy get his game on Steam in the first place? Did it get under the green light process? Was there different rules back then?
Yeah, it probably wasn't Steam Direct if it's a month old.
Yeah, no. So it must have been,
which is the new system where you can just pay a fee and get on Steam.
Exactly.
Right. It's $100.
So he might be just kind of some last vestige of an earlier era that somehow skirted by. There's a lot of games coming out on Steam, right? The game recently came back up on Steam, albeit in a censored form, where the black bars during the sex scenes are enabled by default and just there. You can't get rid of them unless, and I've yet to really check this for myself, the developer posted a blog that included a link to a censor removal patch, which supposedly, you know, you download it from his website. It's not integrated in Steam at all. But if you extract and place this in a folder in the game's directory, it will remove the black bars, supposedly. But this morning, after checking the download, it's just a text file that says, fuck censorship, and you're welcome. So I don't know. I don't know if it actually works, if there's some kind of check.
I feel like it has to actually work, because otherwise the blog post would be very weird. And unless, like, he hasn't made the patch yet, because the whole thing of the blog post is, like, it's a pretty common thing for games on Steam to have censorship that can then be third-party removed with, like, a simple, easy-to-add-in mod. Mm-hmm. So it would make sense for them to just do that. Like, it's the tiniest additional step for people who want to get this through Steam. It's worth noting, like, you can still buy the fully uncensored version game directly from them or through other platforms. The issue is just when you're buying it on Steam. So, like,
I don't know. I've yet to check if it actually works or not. I feel like just a big edgy.
If it doesn't, middle finger. That would be very weird.
Yeah, it's a lot of effort for a middle finger that a lot of people won't even know went up. But it brings to mind for me, you know, the question of what is and isn't allowed on Steam and why. There are a lot of games on Steam that have full blown nudity. There are more tasteful, I would say, games that deal with sex and depict sex that are still on Steam and, you know, haven't been removed from sale for similar complaints. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering why you guys think House Party, of all the games, you can just seriously go to the nudity tag and you'll find just a buttload of stuff, of all the games on Steam was removed. And if this is just an indication that Valve needs to have clear guidelines for this thing, or if they should even allow nudity and sex to be depicted in their storefront at all. We have gore to the max, we have shooting to the max, and, you know, we can't compare them directly because they're very different things and they mean different things culturally, and sensitivities differ all over the board, and it's, you know, playing with fire at that point. But I'm wondering, what does this say about the future of Steam and games on Steam?
Well, it sends a confusing message to developers of these games. That's the first thing, right? So, like, if we're asking and sort of scratching our heads, like, what makes this game special or so offensive that it should be excluded, temporarily taken down, you know, reworked? Is it because it got popular? You know, is it because of, you know, was the game like mislabeled at all within Steam or miscategorized at all within Steam? Did it try to circumvent anything? I'm not sure. I guess one of my bigger questions is, you know, I'm actually unfamiliar with what the kind of parental controls are within Steam. You know, what are sort of the built-in blockers for age gating? I know, obviously, like if you go to certain games pages, you just have to verify your age. But like, what's preventing me, you know, the hypothetical parent of a 14-year-old or something, from like, I don't want my kids to have access to these games right now, whatever. Do those tools exist, you know? And who's responsible for for sort of tagging, like, what isn't part of those games? Because obviously not every game on Steam, and actually most of the games on Steam at this point, are not ESRB rated. Mm-hmm. So who determines what is and isn't, like, adults or only or mature, you know? There isn't some sort of advisory board reviewing all these games. Is it left to the hands of the user, the developers? Steam and Valve obviously aren't doing it. So I don't know. A lot of questions there. You think it would have been figured out by now, but you know,
there's a lot of things about Steam that you would think have been figured out by now that have not.
I mean, I guess the broad answer is, like, Valve prefers to keep things really loose on the hopes that sort of their systems will and the community certainly will police things, you know, 90% of the time. Well enough themselves, which I don't know, is probably true.
Hopefully, maybe in some cases you just get fidget spinner in the nudity tag,
and they just prefer to intervene in these, like, case by case, you know, games and moments where things get out of line. But I'm not sure why.
I think a parallel you could potentially draw is to if you're thinking about a media and a platform for that media, is compare it to YouTube, like. For a very long time, YouTube had a very strict no nudity policy, and everything with any bit of nudity was removed. It's the kind of thing that is still enacted on places like Facebook and Instagram, that they come down pretty hard on any bit of nudity. Mm-hmm. This, you know, people have rallied against these things by, you know, such things as the Free the Nipple campaign, for example, which... saying, like, why is a male nipple considered fine, whereas a female nipple is considered obscene? That's a whole different argument. Right. But if you bring it back to YouTube itself, I don't remember when this happened, but sometime many years ago at this point, they changed their policy. And you now it's pretty easy to find nudity on YouTube. I believe the original argument was like YouTube is meant to be a family-friendly platform with, you know, there's a lot of kids on the internet. I mean, like, obviously it's not hard to find nudity on the internet, like, without parental controls, and, you know, it should come down to the parents doing the policing. Like, you can't totally police these platforms. But yeah, if you compare Steam to YouTube in that case, like, what is it that gets one thing removed from YouTube? Because I'm sure there are things, like, there is a certain type of content that does not get on YouTube, and that is pornography. Like, there is no real definition of pornography aside from the famous quote of I can't define it, but I'll know it when I see it. and to that end, like, yeah, I guess it does come down to these case-by-case basis, and maybe it was just that this game, you know, maybe I didn't even realize there was a lot of nudity on Steam, I guess, outside. Like, obviously there is through, like, modding and third-party stuff, but as far as, like, actual games go,
The game depicts sex, right? You can participate in sex, so maybe that's the distinction, right? So there are a lot of games that depict nudity, but how many allow you to just have intercourse?
I feel like that is a definite distinction in the situation.
Absolutely, you know, and I have not played some games that might depict it as well, like Lady Killer in a Bind.
I have played Lady Killer in a Bind, and it talks about sex very explicitly. It has nudity. But the sex scene, I mean, for one thing, it's a visual novel, so
it is
at most like maybe a GIF, but for the most part, they're basically just static pictures. And from what I remember, I don't remember seeing explicit penetration.
Right.
I mean, that game, it was originally not allowed on Steam, and then it was only in a, censored form, and I believe it now is available fully uncensored on Steam.
So based on that, it seems like Steam's policy is evolving. That's kind of the state that it's in. You know, as more of these kind of games test the limits, they set precedents and define what is and isn't okay. And, like, up until now, it doesn't seem like there have been that many cases that have sort of pushed up against that envelope or whatever. So
yeah, we're getting there. So I think this is sort of like the first wave of instances we'll see, and we'll be paying attention to them in the future.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of weird VR projects out there. So
I mean, that's going to be a big marketplace regulation issue, I think, because I mean, so to again make the YouTube comparison, the future of this is either Steam has to come to a place where this type of content is allowed or is not allowed. At some point, a line will be drawn. And the question is, depending on where that line is drawn, is there going to be enough content on the other side of that line for a dedicated marketplace to exist? And in other mediums, there has, like, obviously, there is YouTube, and then there are the porn variants of YouTube. Even within the specifics of anime, there is websites like Crunchyroll, and then there is the hentai-specific website, Faku.
I did write, it was maybe half a year ago, and I should check up on it, but a digital distribution platform for sex games. I don't think it ever took off.
Or I mean, so that's the issue.
It's in its infancy.
The reason why it matters so much in this case about things being allowed or not allowed on Steam is because of the prolificacy of Steam itself. It is the de facto distribution system. It is like having your game on Steam versus not on Steam is a game changer. It's the difference often between your game surviving and not surviving.
My question is now, very important question to wrap this conversation. What is the adults only version of Steam called? Don't have to answer. Just want to.
Because Steam would actually be a good name for it.
Yeah, right? I know.
That's the issue. How about Sweat?
Yeah.
Ooh, Steam and Sweat.
Steam and Sweat. Mm-hmm.
A little button in the corner you click. I do want to point out, Favis says there is a family mode in Steam that I just totally spaced, and he says it works pretty well for him in blocking.
What's the adults only equivalent of big picture mode? It's big something mode.
Right? Oh, I know exactly what it is.
Okay.
But I'm not going to say.
All right.
Let's move on to Twitch chat Q&A.
Yeah.
So for all of you in chat, tag at PC Gamer with any question you have about video games directed our way. We will favor Twitch subscribers and club members. Club members, if you are not a Twitch subscriber or if you don't have a special decal next to your name, go ahead and ask your question in the Discord, the Ask PC Gamer channel. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, we have a club. It's called the PC Gamer Club. I'm going to link to it right now. And it's a pretty cool deal. You get to join our Discord community full of a lot of cool people. We regularly play games with them. Battlegrounds is so much fun with those guys. Tell you what, they're funny. The Bathroom Boys, as they're called. You get a digital subscription to PC Gamer Magazine, which is awesome because there's a lot of great stuff you don't see on the website that goes into those. You get a special, I forget the handbook, the RPG.
Ultimate RPG
handbook with some really cool stuff. You get an ad-free experience on our website, which is just, it's just beautiful. And you get, free games once a month. You also get free, you might get some, you know, codes and access to betas and stuff. Whatever we find, we'll throw your way. And best of all, I might be leaving something out. You get very rare images of Geralt from The Witcher in a bathtub.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
High res.
They're the only photos of The Witcher 3 we have.
Is that something in that video game?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure that's the entire video game.
I that's the only part I remember, honestly, from it. I forgot how to take pictures in The Witcher anyway, so...
I'd like to think that we can take some responsibility for this Witcher 3 coloring book,
which
includes
a
page of Geralt in the tub, top down, color it how you please, you know.
I'm gonna link to that real quick because it's amazing. I can't believe it. There's an adult coloring book for The Witcher 3 coming out, and they have a tub Geralt image.
While you're tracking that down, I'm gonna jump on a question that I saw in there. I forget who asked it, but it was, what's your earliest memory of PC Gamer?
Oh my gosh.
And I've got one that really sticks out to me. It's going to be one of the magazines from 1997. I mean, I'm sure I read it before then, but for some reason, the Duke Nukem Come Get Some issue, that was like the big headline on the cover. You open up the cover and it opens up into that like, two-page spread ad for Quake 2. It's like bright neon green, and I've still got that magazine. When I flip through it, I remember like every single ad. I would like just sit there and, you know, forget the articles, whatever. I would like fixate on and fantasize about like, oh, I'm gonna get this game, I'm gonna play with my friends, I'm gonna master it and all that kind of thing. And I just like, I have like distinct memories of having those sorts of feelings of like, you know, fantasizing, anticipating games that like in this age of the internet and like massive information and gameplay footage and access and there's just such a volume of information out there about a game that like is not an experience I have any longer.
No.
You know, where I look at an image or a tagline or a piece of text, you know, a lot of these ads in the 90s, they were like very wordy. You know, they had like little screenshots embedded at the bottom and stuff like that. They weren't the sort of like stripped down treatment that you'll get in modern advertising and marketing. Like you just spend a week or a month looking at that, you know, until the game came out and that's the material that you have to work with. And like whatever your friends can like speculate about in the lunchroom, you know, at school. And that was like a really special moment for me as a gamer of uncertainty about like, oh, like, oh man, you know, taking the projection of, you know, that sort of like statement that the developer's making about the game and my mind kind of running with it. I really had that experience with Tribes and Half-Life and a bunch of other games. So
cool. Yeah. I remember seeing PC Gamer in my grocery store, and it was like the only game magazine they had in my small town. And it was a lot of fun.
Man, good town.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still there. It's really weird going back there and seeing it now and knowing that some of my words are in there. It's, I feel pride. But I actually remember listening to the podcast when I was like 14. I think it was one of the earliest. It was actually one of the very first regular gaming podcasts, as far as I can remember. I remember Evan showing up on it a few years later, and I can't remember some of the early hosts, but it was.
So this is probably like 2006 or 7 or something?
Somewhere in there. I was a teen. So those are some of my earliest memories beyond many, many magazines and dreaming.
James Davenport, impressionable podcast teen.
Exactly. How about you, Bo?
I don't know. Like, I'm pretty sure that the magazines that I read. Like, I was an EGM subscriber. That was my go-to gaming magazine. And so I'm sure I read PC Gamer early. It was, you know, probably more of a newsstand pickup. But it's hard for me to think of, like, what the actual first hard memory is of that.
Yeah, that's okay.
No worries. Let's move through some of these. Have you guys seen the trailer for Ready or Not? Do you guys know what he's talking about? This is from Stabby McStabStab 12.
Oh,
Ready
no.
Ready or Not.
Is that a movie, though? I just saw someone talking about it on Twitter. I thought it might have been a movie.
Well, we'll find out after this, I'm pretty sure.
I missed that one.
Thanks for the question. I should say, I think Varen Deal asked the PC Gamer memory question. Hazmuffin asks, did Bo realize he name-dropped his favorite adult site?
I named what?
You name-dropped your favorite adult site. He doesn't remember. He doesn't know. No. He doesn't know. Definitely not who you think. What is the game each of you are looking forward to the most at this moment?
Oh, this is an easy one. It was our E3 game of show, Hunt Showdown.
Yeah, that game looks really cool. Looking.
So,
oh my God.
I think I put it this way on Twitter. So I have like a certain number of hyperbole tokens each year that are allocated to me like as an allowance.
Yes.
And I've spent one of them into this machine of discourse, into that coin slot, to say that I think Hunt Showdown might be the next Crysis.
It looks really good.
So when I say that, I mean, you know, think about the technical and design ambition hype around Crysis, you know, at launch and after launch, when it, you know, so much so that it became, you know, obviously that meme of, but can it run Crysis? Yeah. You know, it's such a demanding, you know, boundary pushing experience that you need new hardware in order to experience it, right? So Hunt Showdown, just go read our stuff on the site about it. You know, we wrote a ton about it around E3, but it is Crytek making it. And
convenient for can it run Hunt.
There you go. But it's, you know, it's essentially a like their take on a first person competitive, but also somewhat cooperative survival game. But the art direction is just breathtaking and exciting, you know, sort of this swampy bayou set in sort of like the Gilded Age of like 1800s or so. That kind of weapons and technology, really seriously scary monsters that don't seem to sort of be like, you know, boss enemies as you would think of them in normal games. And permadeath, you know, so you roll into this, you know, big swamp environment, a boss enemy spawns in a random location. You have to gather clues in this like really dark, scary, you know, hazardous environment filled with other enemies along the way in order to find where that boss is. You're in that environment with your battle partner. You know, it's like a 2v2 v2v2 setup, and all these other teams are trying to get there first. Kill the enemy and then take the bounty, which is, you know, basically like proof that you've killed it, and then get the hell out of there in order to earn like credits and experience and stuff. But if you die, you lose your accumulated stuff for that character, basically. So you lose the gear you brought in, your weapons, your ammo, any like special equipment and stuff like that. There's still like some meta progression within the game, but I love that risk reward of, watching the footage for it, what's most promising is the moments where the developers are playing and they're saying, they see some guys in the distance. They're like, let's ignore them completely. Let's not shoot them at all. Like,
that's not worth it.
That's a super encouraging sign to me. And what this game is not is, it is absolutely not some sort of capitalizing on Battlegrounds. It's not some sort of Me Too experience on that. So I really think they've got kind of the best of what's exciting right now in gaming. If you look at Battlegrounds and that kind of experience, but with a lot of like darkness filled in, tons of gorgeous art, unique setting, and then got that like kind of roguelike element to keep it interesting. So some good ingredients.
Yeah. I posted a link in the chat. Read up on it. It's really cool. Watch that video. That spider's terrifying. I'll quickly say Destiny 2. I'm going to beat that drum pretty hard for a long time, so I won't expand on that.
For me, in the short term, I'm really excited to play Tacoma. I know it's like cool. It's out, but I'm super excited to play it. In the medium to long term, I've mentioned this before, but pretty stoked for the XCOM 2 expansion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, end of this month, right?
It's August.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
That's weeks away.
Oh, yeah. Fine. Time is fine.
Oh, man, that's good. I'm happy now.
Me too. Let's fly through some more questions quick because I know Bo's got to take off soon. Yeah. Buttface Jones asked before the show, because he's on a big Iron Bird in the sky right now, if Game of the Year voting was right now, where is PlayerUnknown's Battleground on your personal lists?
Yeah, that's a really good. That's going to be a really good debate at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a really tough conversation, right? Because for me, I think they would have to fill out more of the experience for me to really justify putting it up at top.
Easily top 10 though, like obviously.
Oh yeah. Top 10, yeah. I'd say top 5 for me personally. But what I think what we're careful to do is not sort of conflate, certainly not popularity and certainly not like, we and our friends together had a lot of fun, and there's just sort of this like positive feeling behind a game. Like that's not why we choose a game of the year, at least not what I put my weight behind. For me, like there's an element of like technical evaluation, does this game like really kind of check the boxes as a PC game, in terms of netcode and all that kind of stuff that we expect. And does it represent like an interesting idea that it pushed forward? Obviously like it's based on H1Z1. Like how do you sort of, value that. But I don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how stuff like the XCOM expansion, which we're expecting a lot of good things from, but it is a, derivative piece of another game that we really love. Like, how does that stack up? But I don't know. What else is in there right now? That's the better question. Like, what's its competition? Far Cry's out next year.
Next year. So that's nothing
out,
jumps
that's,
out.
That's out of the picture.
Like we almost have an easy job because there's a ton of really great games out right now. And I see all of like my non-PC colleagues saying like Game of the Year this year is going to be impossible to judge because they have like Breath of the Wild and they have whatever that game that just like Splatoon 2 people are really stoked about. Like there's all these games that are console specific. And I'm like, we don't have to worry about those at all. PC specific, obviously Battlegrounds. I don't even know, though. There have been some good hits, but I can't remember them off the top of my head.
Was Resident Evil 7 this year?
Yeah, it was February, I believe.
Damn,
RE7.
Yeah.
There's some good ones in there. We'll know in, when time comes down to it and we have to do it.
Mass Effect Andromeda.
Oh, boy.
Bo. One more question.
That's a no. It was unnecessary.
One more quick question. Kanifu, I did not skip your question. Kanifu wants to know if we have any embarrassing video game crushes.
Oh, of like in-game
characters. Of course.
Characters.
Every custom-made character I've ever made, ever.
Boy, embarrassing ones? I don't know about... I mean, they're all embarrassing,
Well, they're all
right?
pretty... It's Yeah, I was going to say...
Inherently. Kind of, I don't know.
When I was a teen, Half-Life 2, Alex Vance, I was just like...
Oh, sure.
Ooh, I was way into Alex Vance. So I don't know if that's embarrassing. That's kind of a given. But nothing too. Maybe just like the archetypal elven archer MOBA character I sort of have a soft spot for, and I don't know why. It's like, yeah, I like the bow. I like the cool cloaks they have.
The girls who bow.
The girls who bow.
Girls whom bow. I don't know. I mean, Zoe was like a really beloved character in Left 4 Dead 1 for a while, right? She's like, the cute like relatable, likable, hoodie wearing, you know, person around my age. Yeah. I feel like, yeah. you know, a lot of fan art made about her.
That's true. I'm going to say Bubsy. Sonic and Bubsy.
It's all that, tales. All that needs to be said.
That's deeply embarrassing.
That's pretty bad. I mean, if we're on the subject of Sonic, then it's definitely Rouge the Bat.
Oh, here we go. This is okay. I think this is a good place to cut it.
Wow. Yeah.
We're about to.
We're going
to
go.
The fact that you knew the name of the female bat character in Sonic.
Sonic Adventure 2.
Deep. He knows all the side characters.
That game is great.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for joining us this week on the PC Gamer Show. Sorry for that last bit, but if you're listening at home on some podcast feed, iTunes or some RSS network, you know, leave us a review if you can. If you like us, you give us all that feedback. If you're watching on YouTube, you can always catch us, you know, 1 p.m. PT here on twitch.tv/PCGamer live if you want your questions answered. And again, if you want to join us in the Discord outside of the PC Gamer Show's hours for all sorts of games, and chatting and just to hang out. We're in there all the time, club.pcgamer.com. And you can get a subscription and join us and change your life forever. It's a good time. Any closing words, fellows?
The conversation continues on Discord. Yes.
Bo, any other Sonic characters you want to shout out?
I think that Evan said it all.
Okay.
Bubsy.